who left Moses. In a word, all the previous forms were unorganized, unplanned. Reactions, unplanned, spontaneous reactions to situations that they could not be confronted, that they had to confront, and they did not know how to confront such situations. They were generated, basically, the previous forms, by a mob mentality, which gets easily excited, but also can regain easily its equilibrium. The Korach controversy was of a totally different character. The rebellion was not due to ungratified physical desires, such as hunger and thirst. Not at all. Second, the crowd was not involved at all. The masses were not involved at all. The army, the mob, which demanded from Aaron he should make them a god, the army, which protested to Rephidim, they are thirsty, they want water. The army, which wanted to stone Moses and Aaron, I mean, during the Meraglim episode, was not involved at all. The mob did not participate in the anti-Moses campaign, if I may call it. Only individuals, but the leadership consisted of several individuals. The followers, few hundred most. Hamisim Masainish, Makhtiri Akhtiras. All individuals, mostly of the intellectual elite, of the aristocracy, were involved. The Torah tells us, the Siedo, Fruemeid, Anshishen, princes of the congregation, called into the assembly, men of name. This was a rebellion. Not just a quarrel, a rebellion. An organized movement, well planned and painstakingly prepared. In short, we should use a colloquial legal term as a Korach conspiracy. There was no conspiracy as far as the episode of the Meraglim is concerned. No conspiracy. Everything was spontaneous, unorganized, unplanned. Immediate reaction to fear, to the story about the giants. But in Korach it was a conspiracy, premeditated and carefully thought out. It was a real rebellion. Apparently, if we see trace, I mean, the history of that rebellion, what psychologically prompted it, what is the etiology of that rebellion, we should follow the Ramban. Ramban is excellent in this regard. Whatever I say here, I mean, about the background, you may find the Ramban if you study the Ramban carefully. Apparently, Korach's enmity was incurred by Moshe at the time of the elevation of Aaron to the high priesthood, Rashi quoted to the Medrash, the high priesthood and the appointment of the Levites as mere servants in the sanctuary, apparently. He didn't like it. However, but this happened a year before. However, Korach, in spite of the fact that he was angry, and Moshe incurred his enmity, did not attempt to come out publicly against Moshe. Since he understood very well that the people, notwithstanding minor incidents, were devoted and loyal to their great leader, and that any attempt to unseat Moshe would be met with anger and derision. He awaited.
Yeah.
Patiently he waited for the for an opportunity. For an event that will somehow undermine Moses' position and his popularity. He waited for Watergate. He hated Moshe. He left this hatred and he was hoping that opportunity, the opportune moment, would arise. And, as a matter of fact, the opportune moment did arise sooner than Kerach anticipated. The Meraglim incident. Perhaps this was the most tragic incident in Moshe's life. The Meraglim incident episode and the suspense decreed by the Almighty that all adults die in the desert was a hard blow to Moses' prestige in the eyes of the crowd. For a while, a short while, he lost the grip over the crowd. His grip over the crowd. He was the sinner. Moses promised on behalf of the Almighty. The slaves in Egypt, before they left Egypt, while they were still busy building baths and fortresses for Pharaoh, he promised those slaves that they will enter into the promised land, into a land flowing with honey, with milk and honey. And they'll promise they'll enter the land in short time after the departure from Egypt. Indeed, when we read Balesra, they were ready to invade the Negev the second year after following the Exodus. As it is related to us in Numbers 10:29, Vayimer Moshe v'chivot beruil amidyoni, chesel neshe, moisim anachno amokim asher omer adeshem, esei etin lochem v'chol itano. We are journeying to the place which the Eternal said, I shall give to you. Come down with us. What place was Moshe talking about? The promised land was ready to enter. Of course, they wouldn't have entered Eretz Israel from the east, but from the west, from the south. Suddenly, like a lightning bolt of a clear blue sky, they are staying in the wilderness, who was extended for 39 more years. Suddenly, all the hopes, all the dreams, that soon will invade the land flowing with milk and honey, got dissipated, shattered. No land, no conquest, no rivers of milk and honey, no realization of the promise Tavesi were in sight. It became a reality, suddenly became a vision. Many, many bleak and dreary years will have to pass before Israel will set its foot on the soil of Canaan, the promised land. Where is Moses' pledge? We ask each other. And Kerach liked to ask those questions. Those questions were very encouraging to Kerach.
Oh,
you realize the time is arrived.
Air conditioning works automatically here, or what?
Where is Moses' pledge? Where is his clairvoyance? Where is his prescience? Where is his prophecy?
I think we'll have to have it on from time to time.
When people used to talk to each other, how will it be possible to endure so much hardship in that dreary wilderness?
Okay, I have some
39, 40 years. The people complained, but there was a complaint of hopelessness. Moses' popularity was at a low ebb. Now, Kerach thought, the time has arrived and I may reveal my plans to other people against whom Moshe discriminates. And Korach started to recruit disgruntled and frustrated people and organized a formidable opposition to Moshe. More or less, the Ramban interpreted. Because when the Rebbe Ezra said that the incident of Korach happened immediately after the construction of the Mishkan, Ramban said, no, it happened after the miracle in episode. And that Ramban is right, and Rebbe Ezra is wrong, we have proof, ample proof on the Pesukim. What did Dothan Vaviron tell Moshe when he sent for them and invited them to come over? Afnei al eretz zo v'azchono v'dvosha v'yisono v'atitin lonu nach laso devekam. You didn't bring us into the land as honey and milk, and you did not give us a share in that land. It means your promise did not come true. Interesting is the word Vayikach. The word Vayikach was interpreted by Rashi in two ways. One way, it's a very obscure word. I mean, the semantics of the word is very obscure. In one way, Rashi says, Lokach es atzmei litzat echot. Mi is nechlak mi teicho eido. Le'ire rala kuhuna. Not to translate English, but I mean, the meaning is obscure. He betook himself on one side with the intention or view of separating himself from the community so that he may raise a protest regarding the priesthood. I mean, this is our interpretation, translation of Rashi. What Rashi means, Korach made the final leap. Until Korach, no one dared to impugn Moses' authority. Right, people were angry, so they said, give us water, give us food. We remember the flesh part of Egypt. Yeah, but they stood in war before Moses. Korach was the first one. Korach has actually. He dared, for the first time, to separate himself from the community which was committed to Moshe, revered Moshe, loved him, in spite of everything, and was loyal to him. He was the first one. I believe that Lotte Hesatzne, he took himself in something else. He dedicated himself completely to that task. He took himself, he dedicated himself to this task. There was only one goal in Korach's life. One goal. He was ready to sacrifice his life in order to achieve that goal. Namely what? To unseat Moshe. To demote Moshe. He dedicated his whole self to this diabolical plan of undermining Moses' exalted position within the community. Vayikach means he committed himself totally to the implementation of that plan. However, it was an individual affair. He did not let in anybody else. He decided, he hated Moses. He did not betray hatred. He did not disclose to anybody. He waited. At the beginning, he did not reveal anything to the prospective conspirators, yet, at the very instant, the divine decree condemning the Jews to 40 years sojourn in the wilderness was announced, Korach immediately revealed his plans to Dothan Vaviron, because he thought that the golden opportunity has offered itself. And Rashi has another pshat of Vayikach. Vayikach, Moshach, Roshi, Sanedroi, Shebohem, Bidvorim. First, he decided himself to fight against Moses, to defeat Moses, to remove him from the his stomach was filled. Yeah, but he had not, but he had no courage to review the $20. But following the incident with the Maravin, his Mossach was his Sanhedrin. He attracted the chiefs of the Sanhedrin, of the courts, by fine words, clever words, intelligent words. Chazal say, Tirach Shepitiach Oya. Tirach was a clever, intelligent man. How did Chazal know about it? Because he made money, so he was a rich man, all right? A rich man is you. Not only is a rich man a clever man, intelligent man, and there are many stupid people who are rich, because his arguments, we will analyze his arguments, are indicative of inner intelligence. So even the Rosh Sanhedrin, the heads of the court, he convinced that righteousness is an insight. And Rashi says, these fine words, he began to conspire. Now the conspiracy began. He began to conspire, to criticize, to attack, and to ridicule Moshe. Tirach used all the weapons of the arsenal of refusal, of conspiracy. To some, in conversation with some, he was serious. In conversation with others, he was humorous, sarcastic. In conversation with some, he played the role of the persecutor. In his conversation with others, he was the champion of justice. He was very capable. And he involved, interestingly, the Bnei Reuven. So Rashi says, why Bnei Reuven? Why the tribe of Reuven became involved so easily in the conspiracy? So Rashi says, Eilu Rosh HaVeilu Shchene. Next door neighbor of Terach. So he met Terach too often, too many times. Terach succeeded in convincing. The Ramban already mentions it. But the Bnei Reuven had also a grudge against Moshe, against Jacob, but he couldn't do anything to Jacob. So he transferred the grudge to Moshe, because Reuven was deprived of the prayer of Kehuna and Levi and Moses. They also nursed a grudge against Moses. They also felt hurt, because Moses took away the prayer from them, the privilege of Malchus and Kehuna and Levi. However, any conspiracy or organized movement, in order to succeed, any rebellion, in order to make headway, no matter how egotistically this rebellion is motivated, in order to make headway, to succeed, must develop an ideology. If it's a spontaneous reaction, if two people quarrel, there is no need to develop a philosophy or to quarrel on behalf of ideas, to represent ideas. But if Korach, planned a movement, it was a movement, it was a conspiracy, it was an anti-Moses movement. So such a movement cannot exist, cannot succeed, without developing the proper ideology. The motto, any movement must have a motto. A motto is indispensable. And Tirach indeed did provide the philosophy of the rebellion. And the theory is interested to tell us not only about the facts, the events that transpired, but also about the ideology which Tirach formulated. And simply, I believe, the Parsha is out to tell us the distinction or the difference between the Moses approach and Korach's approach to certain matters. Let us concentrate. Well, what would you say? How many arguments did Korach employ? Common arguments, ideological arguments, in order to justify his attitude, his stand. How many? What would you say? How many? I believe there was only one argument. It branched out later, with several. But I'm going to investigate basically I'm going to investigate two arguments here. First, the argument which Descartes has related at the very beginning of the story. And second, an argument which Descartes has not mentioned at all, but somehow, in a mysterious way, we don't know how, Chazal had introduced the argument about the trees. Let us concentrate first upon the most potent of all arguments that Kirach advanced against Moses. Namely, with the argument which Yudhira stated at the very beginning of the story. Vayikoru al Moshe val Aaron, vayimru aleihem, rav lachem, kisholayidu kulam gdeshim, ubesecho mashim, ולמות תשנצו על קהל אדישם. He has gone too far, for all the community is holy, all of them are holy, and the Lord is in their midst. Why then do you raise yourselves above the congregation of the Lord? It is a solid argument. Thus, the problem of leadership and exercise of power was raised. Kirach thought, apparently, that Moshe seized power illegitimately. He usurped power. That Moses is a usurpator. He impugned Moses' authority. He challenged Moses' authority. And the basis of this challenge was very simple. And at first glance, quite logical. No one can deny Korach's assertion that the whole community is holy. Is it a lie? Is it a lie of Korach, sir?
No,
it's a lie of the And that every Jew possesses intrinsic sanctity and inner charismatic quality, elevating him above others. No one can deny it. This is the very essence of Tchilas Yisrael. As far as covenantal choiceness and holiness are concerned, I mean, Kedushas Israel, there is no distinction. There was no distinction between Moses and the woodsucker, between Moses and the wood and the water drawer. Not at all. No matter how simple the woodsucker is, no matter how great in spirit Moshe was. Hence, Kirach asked, and the question merits an answer, what right did Moses or Aaron have to lead, to guide, to rule? It is the age-old or millennia-old question pertaining to the principle of equality of man versus election and singling out of an individual. Let us analyze this argument. Kirach was wrong, this is an absolute postulate. Kirach was wrong. Because he was unaware of the twofold character of Kedushas Yisrael. Had he known the mystery of the dual Kedusha idea, he would not have against the argument. What is this twofold Kedusha idea? What am I referring to? And here I must introduce a Rashi in Deuteronomy and Dvarim. I have the Rashi mentioned once in my Shuvah Shurim, whatever I interpret as quite differently than I'm going to do tonight. So I'm not plagiarizing myself. Si am codiciato la dicembre che ho, se posso ti re, un po' boca a dicembre, lì se le am sguo. Rasi è di più, si am codiciato di tussas asne come a dicembre, vei, un po' boca a dicembre, lì le am sguo. Very cryptic, Russia. See, I'm codiciato because Russia apparently could not understand why they tear the duplication in the puzzle. The Tera said, come codiciato la Shemele Kecho, why did the Tera have to continue to say, Ubeho Bocha Radishem, we is Leila Amzgula. Russia couldn't understand it. So Russia said, the Torah has formulated here two ideas of Gdusha. See, I'm codiciato, Gdusha's Atzmecho Mavisecho, ויעיד, מעולה, בכל בוקר עד השם הלכך. That is just translate English. Thou art holy, your holiness comes to you from your father. תפיסס עצמך מיד יפך. ויעיד, בכל בוקר, but in addition to that, did you say, the Lord has chosen thee to be a cherished people unto himself. In other words, Russia tells me thought that there is a twofold idea of Kedushas Yisrael. First, the community as a whole is holy, as an entity. Many times in my lecture, I try to simply put across the idea that Knesset Yisrael is not just a herd, not just a crowd, not just a conglomerate of people, not just a multitude of souls, but it is individuality, it's an entity. It is a personality, a living personality. Knesset Yisrael as a whole. First, the community which we have the most beautiful time, Knesset Yisrael, Ramban, and one speaks about that term in Parshas Chayisah, the most beautiful term, Knesset Yisrael, the community as a whole is holy. This Kedusha of the community, I mean the covenantal community, is inherited from our ancestors. In other words, there is a genetic code of Kedusha. You know what a genetic code is? So we think genetic biological, all these in terms, have a biological genetic code. Rashi knew of another genetic code. Genetic code of Kedusha. Which is transmitted most probably through the genes. Or transmitted to the soul, I don't care. Yeah. But it means it is a genetic code of Kedusha. Otherwise you cannot speak of inheritance. And that's the reason. That if a baby is born to a Jewish mother, juvenilely the baby is considered Jewish. This is Kiyam Kodesh Atol Ladishem Erkech. The baby is a member of the community. The community bestows Kedusha over the baby, on the baby. This Kedusha is inherited from our forefathers. The community is concentrated as a unitary entity. As a whole, the individual, in order to lay claim to Kedusha, must draw upon the resources of Kedusha available to the community. I am holy because I belong to a community. I am united with a community. I am affiliated with a community. And that community happens to be holy, as a whole. So if the whole is holy, if the parts comprising the whole are also endowed with sanctity. The Kedusha, this Kedusha, Kiyam, and it was Kiyam Kodesh, after Ladeshem Melekecha. You are holy as a what? as a people, as a nation, as a community, know what Ham means in Hebrew. Ham in Hebrew means him, together. But means together, Yahweh. It's not a separate holiness, it's not individual holiness, it's not a personal holiness, it's a together holiness. This Kedusha is not a personal, intimate, but a universal, community rooted, and community nourished and centered Kedusha. I am holy because I'm a child of a people who inherited Kedusha from its progenitors. In light of this theory, this theory establishes the supremacy of what? Of community over individual. In words, no controversy among philosophers, meeting them and me. To whom should supremacy be assigned? The individual over the community, or the community over the individual? You know, very well the American social philosophy, since the days of Jefferson, has clung stubbornly to the idea that the individual reigns supreme. But I have, from the viewpoint of the Am Kodesh Atol Abishem Rekeho, seeing this controversy from the viewpoint of Am Kodesh Atol Abishem Rekeho, we may say that the others did not agree with Jefferson or the French encyclopedist philosophers of the Age of Reason, like Montesquieu, so on. It has established the supremacy of the community over the individual. The community is primary, is of primary. The individual is of secondary significance. Again, the community is placed above the individual person. The Am Kodesh Atol Labishem Melekeho. The Nevasek Marxism, actually, I mean, who anyway subscribes to this theory that the community is above the individual. You are consecrated to me as a people, as a nation, as a community. The individual Kedusha is derived from that of the community. Hence, all Kedushot are commensurate and are equal. If the individual derives his Kedusha from the community, so Moshe derived as much Kedusha from the community as the Woodfather did. Clear justice prevails. It is an absolute democratic approach to the partition of Kedusha. There is no differentiation of Kedusha from the viewpoint of the Am Kodesh Atol Abishem Rekeho. However, Yahadus was not too happy with that. Not satisfied with this social aspect of Kedusha. Because this aspect is accepted as the only source of Kedusha. If the community is the only source of Kedusha, then the individual would be deprived of his creative role, of his individual initiative, of his originality and uniqueness. If there is one Kedusha, and only one, rooted in the community, and all individuals receive share per share alike, then the genius cannot be created. The outstanding person cannot develop into a great manix, because there is the partition of Kedusha, alike, the share per share alike. Then the Torah said that in addition to the community Kedusha, Am Kodesh Atol Abishem Rekeho, there is another resource of Kedusha. Where is this resource of Kedusha to be found? In the individual. The individual must discover in himself this resource of Kedusha. The Kedusha which the individual detects And the inner recesses of his personality, he is already personalistic, single, unique. He has Gdusha, no one has the Gdusha like his. There is no share. And this and this cannot be shared with somebody else. It's mine, completely mine, exclusively mine. I could paraphrase the Mama Chazal, he seems to part of him, so the other, me soon in Venice, car be a him. I could paraphrase and say, he seems to be a him, so the other, me soon is, so me so, car be do she say him, person is. From this viewpoint, the community derives what? The Gdusha from the individual. The Gdusha form is integrated of the countless Gdusha experiences of the individual members of that community. Just the reverse of the previous Gdusha. The single person sanctifies the community. How beautifully did the Torah state? Of course you are holy because you are a member of a holy nation. Because you are a particle or a component part of a great holy community. But at the same time, who before? We have the Lord chosen to form a treasured people. There is a separate Gdusha attached to thee, as an individual, as a single person. And the whole Bokha Hadishem, Lios, what means Lios? The whole Yitz, the Torah addresses itself to the individual. It's already said in English. And the whole Bokha Hadishem, and God is charged thee with the mission. What? Lios, what means Lios? To form, to create. And I treasure people. Before, the people precede the individual. Now, the individual precedes the people. And we have the Lord chosen to fulfill a mission. Namely, what mission? Leos, to form or to create or to organize an Amnesgula. We have said the connotation in this context of forming, constituting, or creating an Amos Golor. It is obvious that as far as the Prihas Yechidim is concerned, as far as the election of the individuals is concerned, the endowment cannot be equal. Each individual receives the endowment with what? Which reflects the greatness of his personality. The individual Gdusha experiences are incommensurate and completely proportionate to the individual's involvement, dedication, and to the individual's depth and sleep. The Gdusha is an expression of his greatness, and that all people are alike as far as greatness is concerned. The statement by Korach, Tichol Eid Okumam Gdeshin, is correct as long as we are speaking of the community with that Gdusha. Inherited from our ancestors, Moses was born to Jewish community, and the baby of a slave was born in the Jewish community. They received share and share alike. Their shares in the endowment of sanctity were equal. However, when we shift our attention from the social aspect to the individual aspect of Gdusha, the whole idea of equality turns into an absurdity. Tiach says, Kifolo Eido Kumom Gdushim, Uvesechom Adishem, he emphasized the term Eido. The word, Kifolo Eido, should be translated is the entirety of the congregation. The whole of the congregation is the source of Dushe. However, he forgot that there is another aspect of Dushe, the private, individual one. From that standpoint, from the standpoint of Kiyam Kodesh, Atulai Shemekeho, Korach's argument would have been a solid one. Yet under the aspect, Ubechor Bochar Adi Shemekeho. So you have to admit that Pchiras Meise is above and beyond the Pchira of the Woodchatter or the whatever. Interesting is Meise's answer. What did Meise answer, Kiyam? Vater the Yeda the Shem is a Shalei. The Efa Kodesh Yitzhiriyov. The Efa Shayit Chabei Zak Shiriyov. It's a cryptic mysterious answer. Come morning, the Lord will make known who is His and who is holy, and will grant Him access to Himself. He will grant access to the one He has chosen. Moses speaks not of a congregation. Terah speaks of a congregation. Terah speaks of a congregation. The whole is holy. The part derives its Kedusha from the whole. Your Kedusha is transmitted by the whole to its component part. Moses speaks, the Yidah Adishem is Ashalei. He speaks about private persons. Moses speaks not of a congregation, but as an individual. Vesa Kodesh Yatzevelov. Vesa Shayit Habei. Almost the same time that the Torah speaks in the day. Ubechor Bochar Hashem. Yekorach. Cholei Dekul Agdeishim, from that viewpoint you are right. But another viewpoint of Dushe. Vesa Shayit Habei Yatzevelov. And as far as Pchire is concerned, individual Pchire, personalistic Pchire is concerned, there is a difference between individual and individual. Interesting, Mishka says Beitia. Beitia Vigida, he said, come morning, and the Lord will make known. You know very well that the Radak, Ramban, the Rebbe Ezra, the Aor, there is not a single Mefarsh which has omitted this explanation. Beitar in Hebrew, according to the medieval grammarians, has the connotation of discriminating, differentiating. When you have a vakir, in ben asnuah, ben ahuvah, ben asnuah. Kol yuchal levakir, ben kriv mara. The differentiating between individual forms, Beitar means the period of recognition. And this is not, I would say, Drush, homiletics. That interpretation was advanced by the Radak, by the Ramban, by the Nezra, by the greatest Galerians of the Middle Ages. Beta means the period of recognition, identification of things, events, and people. Erev, in contradistinction, is the time of monotony, uniformity. Erev, they say the Radak is like Ari, Tahuvis, mixture, merger, and oneness. The time of apprehension, Erev is the time of apprehending the surroundings as one amorphous, formless mass. When all tzurot, all forms, all individuals merge into one homogeneous black reality. In the darkness, what do you see? Just a black reality, a black something. Korach, Moshe said to him, your concept of Dushe is identical with the Erev. With the bleakness of an autumnal night, whose darkness and dreariness envelops everything. All you see is one piece of formless reality called Eidah. Hold it. You don't see individuals. Your Dushe is Erev. Your concept of Dushe is limited to what Aristotle used to call to the Hilei, to some amorphous mass, to what the medieval philosophers called Chimera Iuli. to the primordial mixture and leveling off of specific individual traits. Of course, from the viewpoint of Earth, your argument is valid. However, there is another idea of the holy. The personal individualistic holiness, in which the human personality, with all its singular greatness and beauty, participate. This is the holiness of the morning. Baker, the great artist. This is the holiness which discriminates. The holiness which sees individuals. In each individual is the world for himself. It is the holiness which does not look upon the world as a one black, formless mass, but is it colorful, colorful. A world full of song, joy, and individual freedom, and individual greatness. This is the holiness of the morning, when the world emerges from the nightly anonymity into the individuated, distinct morphological existence. As far as this holiness is concerned, the crowd is far below the individual. Each person is consecrated to a unique task that only he can perform. I believe it is you. As a matter of fact, Venus is not a popular subject now. With its two basic performances, acts, Mila and Thule, symbolically represent the two dimensions of this. The universal, community-rooted concept of this, and the individual concept of this. The conduct must attain both aspects. The community-rooted social Gdusha, as well as the individualistic, personalistic Gdusha. The Miller circumcision unites the convert with the community, with the people, or nation. Through Miller, the girl becomes integrated into the community. Basically, Mille is the sign of identity. Will you stop fooling around with it and sit down? Sit down and listen. The Mille unites the girl with the community, with the people or nation. Through Mille, the girl becomes integrated into the community, and by so doing, is given the opportunity to draw upon the communal social resources of Gdusha and to be a component part of the community. However, the personal element of Gdusha is still missing. There can be no conversion without the acquisition of Gdusha at both levels. Therefore, Tvile was introduced. Tvile is indicative of personal commitment. The act of Tvile is inseparably linked up, whoever studied Ivonis once, with Kabbalah Hail Mitzvah, you know very well. When does the girl accept Kabbalah Hail Mitzvah? Direct Tvile. What is Kabbalah Hail Mitzvah? It's not a personal commitment to God. Not through the community, but a personal commitment on the part of the convert to God. There the convert and God face each other. The convert commits himself. The personal individual election is attainable only after the girl separates himself from the community for a short time, retreats into isolation, hiding in the world, immersion, and accepts responsibility not as a member of the community. This kind of responsibility accepted after the ceremony of circumcision. But now you accept responsibility as an individual. Peter, the leader, the son, et sa soleil, et sa connaisse, mais ça sa y frappé à l'échelle. Et il te lève. Now I want to add something. It's also important to know. Tirach charged that Moshe and Aaron were power hungry. They intentionally set up a power structure and raised themselves above the congregation. What always angers me is the arrogant word Bekirach. The moment is nothing or cowardice. It's nothing. You know what in Hebrew is nothing means? The reason, Bagnio Berchagis, is nothing linear and near. And the claims are unfounded. The same as that. Tirach was wrong. He simply did not understand the philosophy of power and leadership as that he had to say to God. He identified the exercise of power with kingship. And the community which is subjected to a power structure, he identified as politeia, or as the political community, or as the state. He was wrong there. This equation of leader and king and the politicization of the relationship between the leader and those whom he leads is always the equation of leader and king and the relationship between the leader and those who are led. And that is again equated as a political relationship. These two equations are wrong. The covenantal community, and this is true, and every Jew should know that, the covenantal community is first and foremost not a political community. And the Jew will not admit it. It is a teaching community. The central figure in the covenantal community throughout the age of the millennia was not the king, never the king, nor the warrior, or high priest, but the teacher, the rabbi. The people are not subjects, as it is customary in the political community. The people in the covenantal community are disciples. The relationship is not of a political nature. It is not rooted in violence, because any political community must use violence. Generally, political community cannot exist without the use of violence. Nor is it connected with the application of sanctions. It is a free commitment on the part of the disciples to their master and teacher. The latter did not impose any authority upon the disciples. No one asked them to obey his words and to follow him. They can terminate this relationship at any time, the disciple. It is a free commitment on the part of the disciples to their master and teacher. The latter did not impose any authority upon the disciples. No one asked them to obey his words and to follow him. They can terminate this relationship at any time, the disciple. You cannot terminate, it's very hard to terminate a political relationship. You know what happened in America during the Civil War? When the states, when the sovereign states wanted to terminate a political relationship. Judaism has disapproved, basically, of all forms of human government. There are definite streaks, but I want you not to misunderstand me. There are definite streaks of political anarchism in our reluctance to recognize man as king. Man, at best, is a melech havyim. And one of the topics of Rosh Hashanah is to contrast melech elyon and melech havyim. And by so contrasting, we condemn melech havyim. Melech havyim is a plasher, nothing else. A daydreamer. Because there is no melech havyim. Because melech havyim is a contradictio in adjecto. God governs. No one else must usurp this prerogative. The only power structure that the Halacha or Judaism has accepted is the non-institutionalized relationship prevailing between teacher and pupil within the teaching covenantal community. Moshe is not known to us as king, even though he was king, by Yibishur Melech. He is known as Rabbi, Meshe Rabbeinu. He is known to us as the greatest of all teachers, as the teacher par excellence, the father of all prophets, even though he was also king, warrior, etc. Aaron is not just a high priest. He is the great teacher. The priest themselves are not just charismatic personalities. Their sanctity is associated with the teaching they engaged. The disciples love their master and listen not to his orders, since he gives none, but to his teachings, which enlighten their minds and gladden their hearts. Moses did not raise himself above the community, as Korach stated and Korach thought, but he was raised by the community above itself. It was raised by the congregation to the exalted heights as a spiritual, not political malchut. And as a matter of fact, spiritual malchut is by far more powerful and more enduring than political malchut. The reflexi forum, the lomotis natso, is out of context, was wrong. Moses was elevated without questing for leadership. He was not a misnase, but a nasu, or nisa. The leader who is the great teacher, he is the holy man. The teacher is simply elected by God to be near him, and his personal Kedusha transcends that of his disciples. Kedusha is an equation. Kedusha teaching. The simple person is the leader, and at the same time, because he is the teacher. Now let us pick up this second argument of Kedusha. The second argument of Korach has not been mentioned in the Bible. Rashi quotes from Tanhume and tells us this following humorous story. Omar Zikinis Rish Nun Rosh Sanhedrin, the Bishop Tawisis Shekum and Treves, Bob Rondo with Nemeshe, Omrule Tawis Shekum and Treves, Hayavis Bitsis Siptura, Amalayan Hayavis, Ishilu Mishrikola, Efsha Tawis Ominacher, Kutechot Shal Treves Petro, Zu Shekum and Treves, Retister Satmo, he attired Kerach 250 chiefs of the court and Israel in robes of treves. Purple, blue, I don't know. Purple woolen, the purple woolen. Then they came and stood before Moses and said to him, is a garment that is entirely of purple subject to the law of cities, or is it exempt? It is subject to the law, answered Moshe. Moshe was alarmed. Certainly. Is it asking, I would also say, subject. Whereupon they began to jeer at him. Is it possible, is this possible, they asked? A robe of any different colored material, one thread of purple. If you attach one thread of purple, it is exempted from the obligation of stitches. And the robe that is entirely of purple should not be exempt. The Midrash tells us another story, which is similar to that of Treves. Namely, they ask Moshe a second question. Should one attach a mezuzah to the doorpost of a house filled with skulls? This is right there. Moses answered in the affirmative, of course. They jeered again and said, is it possible the two short sections, Shema Vohim Shomea, are enough in order to exempt the house from the obligation of mezuzah, while a multitude of Sifrei Torah does not exempt the house from chidush mezuzah? What is the Midrash out to tell us about these two stories? These stories are similar. Almost the motif is identical. And what is the Midrash out to tell us? Because the Midrash felt that these two stories, first, which have a touch of sarcasm and humor as well, will apparently reflect the whole philosophy of Kerach and what he wanted. This is, I told you, Terah developed an ideology. He had a substitute for Terah's mission. He wanted to achieve something, because he wanted to take over. But the Midrash wants to bring out, by relating to us, this sarcastically and good humoredly, these two stories, is, I believe, is obvious. And I would ask people to give me attention, because it's very important. Important as far as our times are concerned. Kerach rebelled against authority. All Jews are equal. Hence, everyone is entitled to interpret the law. It was a question of interpretation of the law. You see, that's why the Midrash introduced the story about the treves, about the mezuzah. If Kerach not only wanted political power, he wanted to remove Moshe from office and succeed Moshe as king. No! He wanted to succeed Moshe as rabbi. That generations, countless generations afterward, should say Kerach Rabbeinu. That was his ambition. Yeah, don't sound. That was his ambition, you understand? So hence, he not only impugned and challenged Moses' authority as king, political authority, but he challenged his halachic authority. Can Moshe interpret the law? Is Moshe wrong? The study of the law, to kill Korach, and to show to the people, to the 250 scholars, The Chief Justice says that Moshe is incapable of interpreting the law. So he posed to Moshe those two questions. Moshe answered in the affirmative, while the 250 scholars, I don't know, I wouldn't have given them smirre, but the 250 scholars have decided that Moshe is wrong. Not only Moshe is wrong, they jeered at him, they laughed at him. They demonstrated him nonsense, absurdity. The study of the law, apparently, Kerach argued, the study of the law and its interpretation, Kerach argued, are exoteric acts, democratic acts, in which every intelligent person may engage. Moses' claim to being the exclusive legal authority and exclusive interpreter of the law, Kerach argues, are unfounded and unwarranted. The consequence of such a democratic philosophy is obvious. What Kerach wanted, and what many want even now, and I'm not speaking only about dissident groups, but I'm speaking about the Orthodox community. What Kerach wanted, and what many dissident groups want now, whether they state it clearly, or they use technical terms and dubious language to cover it up, is that the instrument of interpretation of the Torah be common sense. Or the everyday empirical intelligence, not the esoteric conceptualizing logos, which can only be attained through painstaking study and hard training. In Hebrew, we have three terms which signify the human intellectual gesture. We all know Chochma Bina Das. I'm not going to analyze those three terms, but I want to show you just one distinction. Das denotes, particularly in Talmudic language, common sense. Not wisdom, common sense. Sound practical judgment. We come across the expressions Ben Das, as Ben Das means, an average intelligent person, not an idiot. Or the Mitrofadite, what does Mitrofadite mean? He must be reason, and he reasoned with us. You're correct. A person deprived of Das is an idiot, senseless, foolish. In contradistinction to Das, Chochma Bina refer to scholarship, to specialized knowledge, to a trained logos, to an intellect which was subjected to training and criticism for a long time, to the precise, exact intellect. The Korach group pleaded the case of common sense or das. They argued that every Jew with common sense should have the right to interpret the laws of the Torah and determine halachic matters in categories of common sense categories. There are different categories of common sense. As a matter of fact, right here, the ritual committees in the non-Orthodox synagogues, or perhaps even in Orthodox synagogues, employ common sense in reaching halachic decisions. In fact, all the foreign movements, from the Tzedukim during the Second Commonwealth, down to religious liberalism of today, created the cause of common sense as the instrument of interpretation. I'll give you an example. The Tzedukim of old said, the Mishneh Yedayim tells us, that the daughter inherits the estate of the father if the son died and left only a daughter. If there is a problem, if there is litigation between the daughter of the father and the granddaughter of the father, then the daughter of the father should get the estate. You know what the Purushim said? Purushim said that if there is litigation between the daughter of the father, of the deceased father, and the granddaughter, who gets the spirit? The granddaughter. The Prussian kept on arguing that it would be unjust to discriminate against the legitimate rights of the daughter of the deceased. The Dukin kept on arguing that it would be unjust to discriminate against the legitimate rights of the daughter of the deceased if the heir on the opposite side, its opposite number, is also a daughter, but not the daughter of the father, but a daughter of the son. Why should the real daughter surrender the estate to a granddaughter who is not closer, who is not as closely related to the father as she is? What do you say about it from the viewpoint of common sense, of the exoteric empirical intelligence? That took him right. Well, that makes a great deal of sense. How? In fact, under the aspect of common sense, or the way practical approach, Kirach's argument against Moshe's decision was also valid. If one purple thread is sufficient, why should a purple garment require it? If one can fulfill mitzvah's mezuzah by attaching two parshiot to the door, why should not the presence of many scrolls in the house exempt the latter from the need of a mezuzah? However, and this is basically now a trend in the Jewish communities, in the opportunities, to introduce common sense as an instrument of interpretation. I know what I'm talking about. Some here, I believe, would understand me. However, Torah Shabbat Peh cannot be identified with common sense, with das, it is chokhmah. It has a methodology of its own. It has a singular approach. It has a distinct form of analysis. It has its own categories and its own strange schemata. Fundamentally, the Torah Shabbat Peh avails itself of a method of conceptualization. Whoever knows what Torah Shabbat Peh is and the method of teaching Torah Shabbat Peh, particularly the method which was forged by Rabbi Krieger, so some say that, Rabbi Krieger, Ktzeis, Nesilis, Rabbi Chaim Brisker. Chaim Brisker actually has developed this method to dizzying heights. Is wonders, basically, what we call wonders, consists in the ability to conceptualize Yalach. We conceptualize Sukkah, we conceptualize Bosa the Cholov, we conceptualize Parulis, we conceptualize the whole Torah. Yalach works like the mathematician in an a priori world. Its constructs are ideal. Torah Shabbat Peh does not study reality. It prepares abstract schemata and applies them to the world of sense. Now, I'll give you an example. In fact, Aristotle and the entire Greek science, which unfortunately dominated the Western world throughout the antiquity and the Middle Ages, failed miserably. Aristotelian physics, I don't say Aristotelian philosophy, Aristotelian logic, but Aristotelian physics failed miserably. You know why? Because its foundation was common sense. The empirical human intelligence, which operates usually with platitudes and commonplace ideas. The great accomplishment of Galileo and Newton consisted in replacing the practical common sense approach with a conceptualizing, creative logos. With that, we all call now the scientific logos. What is scientific logos? What's the difference in scientific logos and the lay logos? Of course, the scientific logos is trained. The lay logos is not trained. Scientific logos is precise. The lay logos is not precise. But what is the main difference? The main difference, the scientific logos conceptualizes reality, while the lay logos, or the common sense logos, takes reality at its face value. They proclaimed the principle, Galileo knew, as mathematization and quantification of reality, as converting sense qualities like heat, like light, color, like sound, into quantitative relations, mathematical relations. Now, give an example. Aristotle, for instance, said, all things fall downwards because they are heavy. You see, in other words, he considered the gravitational pull as a result of heaviness or weight. This is nonsense. The reverse is true. Weight is the consequence of the gravitational pull. Newton discarded common sense and approached the matter from the viewpoint of the esoteric, abstract, creative, conceptualizing logos, and came up with his famous formula that gravitation equals the product of both masses over the square of the distance, mm over d in the second potency. In other words, gravitational pull is nothing but a mathematical relation between two bodies, which consists as a product of the masses over the square of the distance. This method of quantification was perhaps the greatest discovery in the annals of mankind. Of course, if we had been satisfied, not we, but in the 17th century, had been satisfied with Aristotelian physics, we couldn't climb now to the moon. Don't you think that Allah is also entitled to such a prerogative? Yet, as I stated above, our unique, logical, and epistemological approach to Allah, basically, Torah Shebaalpeh is not just a compilation of laws. It is a compilation of laws, but it's more than that. Mathematics is not just a corpus of equations. Ask any mathematician. He's intelligent, not stupid. What is math? He wouldn't tell you it's a corpus of equations. Or no physicist. Who understands physics. No physicist will tell you that physics is a collection of natural laws or equations. Basically, science is a method. Mathematics is a method. Physics is a method. It's a method of thinking, a unique logos. So is the Torah Shebaalpeh. The laws and statutes have utmost significance. However, if you discard the view that Torah Shebaalpeh is a system of thought structures and logical categories, unique logical categories, which are accessible to the mind, to the human mind, only the latter is ready to subject itself to a rigid and tough training, then you open up the floodgate and any ignoramus may claim authority the way Korah did. I'll give you an example, for instance. You know now the movement of the women lib, all right, and the complaints against Torah Shebaalpeh, against our Allah. Allah has discriminated against the woman. The woman is not an equal of men in the Allah. That's what I hear. And then the rabbis are ready to surrender. Right. In order to please a few ladies of the women lead. Basically, whoever studied Chumash knows Chumash well. Whoever studied the Gemara knows this discharge is sheer libel. Since the Chumash in Bereishis says that God created man, Zohar and Kev Boreisom, Bitzalim and Elikim Boreisom, that men and women were created in the image of God, equality is taken for granted. If two creatures, if two personae are created in the image of God, you cannot say one is superior to the other. So people come out always and say, why is women postulators disqualified? to bear witness. This qualification to bear witness is completely, if you speak in terms of Korach, of common sense, or Aristotelian terms of common sense, it should be done. Since the lying, I'll look for another witness. I'm one witness, kosher ladies. And I look many times, I look for another witness, and I don't find it. Quite often I can't find another witness who is a Shema Mitzvah. And I don't invite a woman to witness the ceremony, sanction the ceremony. Apparently she's inferior to the male. It is not correct. If the male HaMashiach were present at the wedding, I wouldn't invite him either, because he's also disqualified to bear witness. So will you say that all Jews are superior to the Melech HaMashiach? King Messiah, king is disqualified to bear witness, like a Ish. Will you say that King Messiah, or King David, or King Solomon, or Moshe Rabbeinu himself, were disqualified to bear witness? A Melech is postulated, I can't help it. Would you derive on me the conclusion of it? That David, Moses, and a woodchopper, an ignorant person, a boom in the right face, kosher ladies, if observes the mitzvah. Will he say that the psulaitis can be translated into axiological terms? And the conclusion would be warranted and justified to say that the king Messiah, the Melech HaMashiach, is inferior to some ignorant Jew? If you operate with common sense categories, yes. Kerach operated with common sense categories, and he was right in his conclusion that a tallest tredas is the whole robe is made of purple material, certainly should be exempt from the need of tzitzis. But from the viewpoint of the exact, precise, and unique halachic categories, from the viewpoint of such halachic structure, is Tzitzis is not indicative at all of the station of the woman in society, in the halachic community. The same is true about the minyan. We don't count a woman, of course. Does it mean that the woman is inferior? It's very strange, I said it to my yard, that the greatest teacher of all pertaining to prayer was a woman. The Gemara said, it's not for Chane, we wouldn't be able to pray. So Chane was the greatest of all teachers pertaining to prayer. But Chane herself couldn't have joined the Minyan. Does it mean that Chane was inferior to some ignorant person who was counted among the ten? Not at all. In categories, in common sense categories, yes. But in strict halachic categories, in the strict original halachic categories, is the fact that a woman cannot be counted as the tenth person, tenth or the ninth, as a member of the congregation, has absolutely nothing in common with the axiological problem of equality of male and female. The trouble now is that many people, since to be alumni is very hard, you have to work very hard on it, so many people are ready to exchange alumni for common sense categories. Now let me explain it. The adherents of the common sense halacha, no matter what they call it, whether they call it meaningful halacha, creative halacha, new halacha, there are quite a variety of terms. I'm never impressed by terms and cliches. But actually what they want is common sense halacha. Are misled by a basic philosophical doctrine containing half-truth and platitudes. They expound, since the days of Kerach, more or less, a theory of religious subjectivism. Prima facie, it is hard to refute this theory. It was, as I told you, it was hard to refute Korach's argument of the whole Haida Kulamlish. Because both arguments contain each other of truth. They say, and you have that, probably you heard it quite often, Rachmon and Libeboy, God is interested in the heart. An immense inner world. Faith, fundamentally, is an inner experience. Man, they say, meets God in the mysterious recesses of his personality. The God experience is iridescent, dynamic, bold, and breaks through the exterior of the human personality and turns into objective deeds, into action. In words, they claim, and this is the theory of philosophy of religious subjectivism, which is so popular now in the United States, I mean, it's known under the name, under the trademark of existentialism, religious existentialism. In words, they say, the mitzvot manifest an inner mood, a spiritual quest, a hidden feeling of happiness or sadness. The mitzvot are supposed to reflect the inner experience. The mitzvot, according to them, are external correlates which run parallel to the experiential order. Each experience has its external correlate in the form of action. If this theory, they argue, is correct, then the mitzvot has got to correspond to the mood which they are supposed to express in the most competent way. Hence, the mitzvot must avail themselves of the media of expression which are best fitted to reflect the inner experience. And they argue, the scholars live in a world of abstractions, cannot determine the redemptive power of mitzvot. Only a common sense approach is capable of gauging the therapeutic energy of each mitzvah and to utilize it in the most efficient manner. Korach said to Moses, the blue thread was meant as a reminder to make us think of something, of distance, infinity, of the mysterious link between the blue sea and the blue sky. Why is it necessary to limit this symbolism to a thread and not extend it to the whole garment? From the standpoint, again, of common sense, Halacha, Kirach was right. A beautiful purple robe may have a greater impact upon the individual than a single thread. I agree with the preamble of this theory, only the preamble of the theory, that there are two parallel religious orders in Judaism, the objective and the subjective. Judaism, in my opinion, consists of two things, divine disciplines, call it Shogunov, or any other name, and the great romance between finitude and infinity, between God and man. We have a score in our Tanakh, in our canon, which deals exclusively with this great romance, human shasha. Both deed and experience are inseparably united. The deed without experience is an incomplete act, an imperfect gesture, no doubt about it. As a matter of fact, whatever I say in this context is correct from the viewpoint of strict halachic thinking. The question is, it's very easy to say, that Judaism consists of a double order, sort of an external order of action, of deeds, or divine disciplines, and an inner experience. of an inner feeling of love for Kodesh Baruch Hu, for God. The question is, you have to prove it. Is Allah cognizant of experiential moments? And the problem is, you cannot just say, because I like it, or because if I like it, or people will come to listen to me. I mean, how can you prove it that Allah is interested in experience? Exactly, because certain mitzvahs consist in experience. And I am not referring to the mitzvah of love of God or the mitzvah of love of man. I am referring to ritual mitzvahs. For instance, the Kriyat Shema. Kriyat Shema, even though it is strictly, identified with the recital of a certain fixed and standardized text. However, the Kima mitzvah is Kima Balev, is an experience. The same is true of Tzilah, Avedo Shalev. The same most probably is true of Avelis. The same is true of Simchas Yontos. Notwithstanding the halachic requirement for the recital of standardized text or the observance of external rites, the mitzvahs are consummated, like Avelis, Krishna, Tzilah, and realized in an experience. In other words, even the formal abstract halacha knows of the experience as an important part of the religious gesture. However, and here we reach the boundary. The religious experience is not the primary gesture. It is the secondary. The point of departure must never be the inner subjective experience, no matter how redemptive it is, no matter how colorful it is, no matter how therapeutic it is, no matter how great the impact the experience has upon the total personality of man. It should never be the point of departure. The point of departure must always be the objective external act. The latter, the objective act, does not symbolically express or interpret the experience. Here they made a mistake. The reverse is true. The experience interprets the act. There are a variety of reasons justifying our thesis concerning the supremacy of the act over the feeling. The supremacy of the solid religious reality over the emotion. First reason is the religious emotion is changeable, volatile, and transient, like another emotion. Second, each individual experiences God, man, and world at the religious level in a unique fashion. If the religious act would have to adjust itself to the inner feelings of man, we would have to invent a constantly changing ritual. What the appropriate medium is today will be absolute, or the appropriate medium of expression is today will be obsolete tomorrow. What is good for me does not behoove my next door neighbor. There would be, if the religious experience were the point of departure, and the religious act would have to correspond to the experience, there would be a variety of symbolic actions. We could not speak of a monistic service of God. This kind of ever-changing worship is idolatrous, basically. Interesting is the Rashi in Kerach. Roma Meishele Kerach. If the Jehovim Yeshlem Elohu Sabe, the pagans have many gods. Kiranim Harbe, many priests. Vavidis Harbe, in many forms of worship. Onu, Zoshlonu, Kir Echot, we have one god. Kirin Echot, one high priest. Vavid Lachas, one form of worship. Monistic worship is constant. And monistic worship is not exposed to the winds of change. There is another reason for giving priority to the act over the experience. It is simply impossible to determine what is what and who is who. We can never determine what is a religious experience in contradistinction to a hedonic, mundane experience. We know of many non-religious emotions, hedonic emotions, which are provided with enormous power. They are hypnotic and at first glance redemptive. One may easily confuse the religious drive with the love impulse. It is quite normal to replace the religious ecstatic craving with the aesthetic yearning of the artist. There are common characteristics in both of them. The quest for exaltedness and infinity is typical of both, of the experience of beauty and the religious experience. To substitute secular for religious emotions is again an idolatrous method. The pagans of old used to indulge in hypnotic orgiastic ceremonials and mistakenly identifying them with the religious experience. The Torah prohibited idolatrous practices to be introduced in the ritual and service of God. Echo yavdu agirim ha'ilas alayhem. Vese king amoni. Reisat ha'kin ha'ishem ha'kecho. How did these nations serve their God? Even so will I do likewise. Thou shalt not do so unto the Lord, my God. The Torah had exactly in mind the idolatrous, uninhibited, frenzied, hedonic experiences which the pagans engaged in, confusing them with the religious experience. The rousing of religious awareness by confronting it with the powerful hypnosis of the aesthetic experience, such as music, plastic art, architecture, is alien to Halachic Judaism. For instance, take the organ as an instrument. What's the purpose of the organ? What's the purpose of the organ? The organ serves the purpose. What's the purpose of the organ? Prepare a mood. Yeah. The organ does not prepare a religious mood, because the organ itself is an instrument not of religious experience, but of the artistic experience. So use an artistic experience in order somehow to pave the way for religious mood. The religious mood will never come. The way will be paved by an aesthetic experience. The same is true if you dance. The dance may rouse. May rouse it personally. Of course. Yes, it's stimulating. The rhythm itself is intoxicating. But at all, the rhythm of dancing is a secular experience. It's not a religious experience. It's an aesthetic experience. You expect that the aesthetic experience will pave the way for a religious experience which will follow the aesthetic experience. That will never happen. Will never happen then. Particularly, and that is basically idolatrous. And in my opinion, that is the realism. For the elimination of the organ from the service, or the non-introduction of the organ into the service. You have to want it, and I'll tell you so what, that the religious experience be born in a world of its own, not stimulated or roused by a secular, mundane, hedonic experience. And of course, then if we use as a stimulate the love experience, then it becomes abominable. Yes, this is idolatry par excellence. The religious experience is born within the religious awareness, not under the pressure of physiological carnal drives, not even provoked by spiritual needs of the human personality, such as the need for beauty. The same purpose served the architecture of the cathedrals in the Middle Ages, in particular the Gothic architecture, whoever is acquainted the Spengler's book, I mean, the decline of the Abend of the Western world, the West, how he interprets and he's writing that, to the Gothic experience, the Gothic Athira, who wanted to arouse in the human personality and the experience of infinity, of boundlessness, of questing, I mean, up into the heavens. Of course, perhaps it may actually provoke such an experience, produce such a quest. But it is an artistic quest, it's not a religious quest. And to substitute an artistic quest for a religious quest is idolatrous. You know very well, never mind it, now people speak about architecture of synagogue. There was no architecture of synagogue. We never cared about it. The Jewish synagogue was a plain hall. We never tried to influence the Jew by bringing him into surroundings suggesting a transcendental order or otherworldliness. We never tried to do it. Catholics, yeah. The whole mass, the music, I mean, the architecture, are geared to that purpose, to stimulate the person an aesthetic experience, hoping that by this stimulation, the worshiper will also be aroused to a religious experience. And this is this is absolutely wrong. The religious experience is autonomous, free and original, moves at its own tempo, within its own unique orbit. This kind of independent experience follows, you know when? Follows the deed instead of preceding it. To pray the next prayer, to engage in a dance or in a song, it's okay. However, to dance in order to pray is futile, because one will never pray. Yahadus expected the religious experience to follow the religious act. The great romance follows the divine disciplines, not the reverse. Misha said, if one fulfills mitzvah sittes, then the glance at the thread, at the purple thread, will produce in him perhaps the experience of infinity. If you proceed from action to experience, then the purple color will remind you of the mystery of existence and our link with God. However, if one fails to conform to the halachic norm and contrary to the rules of halacha, avails himself of a common sense approach, the looking or the glancing at the trailers will not produce any reaction. And if a response will be forthcoming, it will be a mundane hedonic response, not a religious response. It will not enhance my religious experience. Blue, experience of blue, if it follows the Kiyuma Mitzvah, is a great experience. But experience of blue, without the Kiyuma Mitzvah, can produce in a vulgar association, vulgar memories, unredeemed experiences. When I hear people talk about meaningful halacha, the unfreezing of the halacha, empirical halacha, I know what the people had in mind, by all the jargon. They had in mind exactly what Kerach and his adherents had when they approached Moses with the problem of Talish Kula Tredes. They wanted a common sense interpretive approach to halacha. They simply had no patience to study, to get the proper training, and to master the unique halachic methodology and logic. They rebelled against the institution of Lomdes. They want to do to halacha what Aristotle did to physics, to convert it into a shallow discipline retreat this platitude and commonplace ordinary opinions. Of course, Moshe won. The Kira group finally admitted that Moshe Emes is the Rosh Emes. We still study the Halacha in light of Moshe, of Moshe's esoteric conceptualizing logic. The Masorah of method has halachic structures and a priori construct which will continue forever. Dichter Olav, Ktir Samim, Babeker, Betiles, Aneres, Yakterano, Ubaalei Sarenes, Aneres, Ben Arboim, Yakterano. And Aaron shall burn the ram incense. Every morning he dresses the candles. He shall burn it. And when Aaron lights the candles, the lamps, the dusk, he shall burn it. The burning of the incense and the lighting of the lamps will be emerged by the Torah in the one mitzvah. As a matter of fact, we have a study scotching, and the scotching well knows that there is a separate view of combining that locus and earth with that Torah factor. There is a separate kiyum of lighting the candles almost simultaneously with the burning of the Torah. What does that locus and earth signify? Light, understanding, knowledge of the Torah, clarity of concept, and the depth of halachic analysis. The clear deed, the intelligent performance. What does Kteres represent? The hidden and the intimate. The mysterium magnum of creation and the mysterium tremendum of divine presence in creation and beyond. The chiso anana Kteres as a Kteres and the cloud of incense may cover the heart. Kteres tells us the great story of human craving for God. Is questing and yearning for the origin. For the makor, for the beginning of all, the symbol tells us a marvelous story of human tragic waiting for an ecstatic unity with the Almighty. The colorful religious experience is represented by Kteres. The clear intelligence religious thought and intelligent action is represented by the candles, by the menorah. The Torah, however, admonished us that the burning of the incense be coordinated with the lighting, the mystery of feeling with the clarity of thinking and acting, the excitement and passion of craving be united with the serenity and peace of halachic comprehension and halachic implementation. Both are necessary. Yes, there is a parallel order of experience and deed, of romance and discipline, of thought and feeling. Yet, necessary. Yet, Kteres cannot be separated from Adlokas and Eres. The subjective must never be isolated from the objective. The Urisimatius Hartem cannot be severed from the Psyotrilus. The halachic detail and halachic precision is necessary if one wants to attain a great colorful religious experience.
Another man.
I want to ask you,